Good evening, everyone. It's nice to see your faces. It's wonderful to know that some of you were in the Sesheen. And it's wonderful to see the pictures, and I can relate to the experience of sitting with friends. And I miss that, like long periods of sitting. I really miss long periods of sitting, and I hope those of you who were there enjoyed it. The beginning of December is the period in the year, during the year, when we celebrate the Buddha's awakenings. It's Ohatsu. It's actually most of the centers who do Ohatsu Seishins do it early December. Though there's not a specific date, because it's the lunar calendar, so it changes from one year to the next. And I think in the next, I think it's supposed to be in January, early January or something, at some point in a couple of weeks. But anyway, it's usually the Seishins usually takes place early December. So we are in the middle of it, in a way. And I was reflecting on, I was linking that to what we were doing on Saturday with some of us, while some others were sitting in the Sesshin, or ending the Sesshin, or no, sitting in the Sesshin. It ended on Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday. Anyway, so we were having a study group struggling with a very difficult text, unclear text. But I think it was very, for me, it was very interesting. What is being said in the text was a text by Genpo, by Wangpo. And it rose a lot of questions in me, that text. And I thought it might be worthwhile sharing, what it brought up for me, because it seems that there is something very crucial about what we actually do, and what are actually the things that potentially the Buddha was practicing, or what is the thing, what are the practices that we should be doing while sitting on a cushion. And to some extent, it seems unclear or contradictory, depending on the sources. So in that text that we looked at, there was a question that was being asked, and in a way, it was targeting towards understanding the nature of mind, or oneness, or the or true nature, or oneness, and how does it actually function with this other realm, diversity, or the world of phenomenon, something like that. And at some point in the text, he says, well, the followers of the usual Mahayana and Theravadin doctrines, so Mahayana, this is for the Tibetan traditions, for example, who rely upon deep perception to arrive at a true understanding. And therefore, they see what is near and fail to see what is far away. I assure you, there is no inner or outer, or near or far. The fundamental nature of all phenomena is close beside you, but you do not see it. You do not see even that. Yet you still go on talking of your inability to see what is far away. The person who asked the question appears not to understand really the answer. And Huangpo gives very clear instructions about what needs to be done when you sit. And he says, first, learn to be entirely unreceptive to sensations arising from external forms. So sounds, for example, or smell. Be unreceptive to sensations, thereby purging your bodies of receptivity to externals. Second, learn not to pay attention to any distinctions between this and that arising from your sensations, thereby purging your bodies of useless discernments between one phenomenon and another. Third, take great care to avoid discriminating in terms of pleasant and unpleasant sensations, thereby purging your bodies of vain discriminations. Fourth, avoid pondering things in your mind, thereby purging your bodies of discriminatory cognition. I mean, if you think of the first instructions you had when you started sitting, just follow your breath. Or if you think of what is being taught in other traditions, and I'm thinking of, or in Vipassana, or in the mindfulness techniques, what is being said in the famous text, the Foundations of Mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutra. It's like being mindful of the body, being mindful of the feelings, being mindful of the mind, which means noticing states of minds, thoughts, emotions, mental qualities. And then the fourth dimension, which is rarely taught but very important, is mindfulness of the dhammas. I mean, all that is really using our discriminating mind, noticing what is pleasant and unpleasant, noticing, in mindfulness we do body scans, so noticing how the body feels and envisioning the various parts of your body. So befriending our feelings, noticing our feelings, noticing the tonalities of a feeling. So all that is like really paying attention and making distinctions. So when one reads the instructions from Huangpo, it seems that it goes totally in the opposite direction. So I was really reflecting on that, and how does that work together? And this was really the core of the question, really, before that this person was asking. How does that work together? I don't understand. And as an answer, Huangpo gives these instructions. No distinction, no discriminating mind. And again, that seems to go totally in the opposite direction of all a series of practices that Buddhist traditions all around share. Any one of you who have ever done a Vipassana retreat, just like following the breath, noticing, tip of the at the end of the air entering. It's like very, very precise. Noticing, is it pleasant, unpleasant? So we are using there, we are using really the our ability to distinguish things. So, you know, does it mean our tradition, the Zen tradition, goes totally the other way and it's totally in the opposite direction? And how does that work? Or is it just a question of emphasis? Something that was emphasized for a long time and maybe that we missed because we emphasized, we focused so much on one dimension that we forgot another dimension. And what is that dimension? In my practice, I use really both. There are times where I really focus on noticing, being very precise on what arises and seeing what arises. And I wouldn't say it's a kind of stage one practice, because it's always wonderful to go back to that and just like, or follow the breath in the sense of counting the breath. And you count the breath, you make a distinction between the first breath and the second breath. It's not just, but also you might also notice that it's one continuous breath also. You notice a thought arising and it's very specific, it's very distinctive. It's very different from the other thought. And of course, you know, we let go of that, we let go of the thought, and the practice is just to let go so that we become more aware of the second thought that arises, the next thought that arises, the next thing that comes up. And maybe it's going to be a sensation. We're able to notice the sensation. And there's also this other possibility to drop once the, and I find that it requires a certain ability for the mind to be fully grounded and calm. And then we don't necessarily need an object to We don't necessarily need to go back to the breath. We don't necessarily need to make it to practice this art of being able to discriminate between a sensation and a thought and different thoughts and different sensations. And this is what is being done in the practice of Shikantaza that we have. We just sit and there's no, the intention, the focus is not on something any specific, on anything specific. We open up. And what do we learn? What do we see? What do we experience when we do that? In both cases, it's definitely a training in the letting go, a training in opening up, a training in embracing our experience. Yet the way we do it is slightly different, maybe. And so this second type of practice has really to do with dropping body and mind, dropping every single notion, every single discrimination. So Saturday we were also sharing, trying to share that experience, what it feels like to be in that state of there's not even me looking at something. And I think we all have that experience in every day, actually, at least once. You don't when you don't you take your cup of to make tea, and you're not thinking, I'm taking that cup. And you're mindfully doing it, and yet you're not thinking, oh, I mindfully take the cup in order to make myself coffee. So I was, that line from the sutra, identity of relative and absolute, kept coming back. Ordinary life fits the absolute as a box and its lid. Diversity and oneness fits perfectly when, so these practices are, we just two sides of the same coin. Two ways to approach it, to approach the practice. I'm not educated enough to know, and I don't know if it's relevant at all, but it's, I was wondering to which extent this emphasis, this particular emphasis is really has to do with the fact that it's very much grounded in the Chinese culture and Taoism and this notion of oneness and all that. So I don't know. But in any case, we have in the text that we have that we chant, the identity of relative and absolute, these two dimensions are a mention. Being able to notice the diversity, being able to distinguish, and the practices associated with that, really just, following the breath, for example, following thoughts. The arising and the ceasing of thoughts, or knowing, noticing, practicing shikantaza that probably has more to do with the experience of the absolute. Though we also have that in the other practice. I guess in the quotation that I mentioned from Hong Po, there was probably that idea that, if you just stick with the what is being practiced in the four foundations of mindfulness and just noticing the distinctions, you miss that other dimension. You miss that other experience that is quintessential of for him, of Buddha's awakening. they're very stuck with language. It becomes very elaborate and very complicated when we try to express in words what that experience of the absolute is. And guess the use of poetry or the use of paradox allows us to bypass that problem. And this is what we find a lot in the Zen literature, and what makes it also sometimes very, very tricky. Yeah, what keeps coming back is that it's the manifestation of that absolute fitting the ordinary life, fitting the absolute as a box in its lid, and how we can experience that in Sesshins by just when we end up going into that rhythm and things starts to be very simple more and more, and we just do what we need to do, what needs to be done, and everyone is that's has its function and its position, and it's becomes this there's the clarity coming up. And I'm trying as much as I can in my daily life as a lay practitioner going all around with all my activities to enter that same space of just doing what needs to be done, just responding, just not being caught with all these thoughts that can interfere, and suddenly the waters in which I swim becomes very murky. And I notice that when that takes place, how it makes sense that these things of discrimination, of separation, and holding on, the clinging, and suddenly there's a quality that is suddenly very there is that is changing very much in the in my experience of how I relate to my reality, to the experience, to others. So moving, going through life like this and feeling that the we're not caught up with discrimination, and it fits. It fits all this relative things that we need to do. It fits the Yeah, what is coming up also now is, as I say, it fits. It's just like also the war that is raging everywhere and how it doesn't fit. And it is a torture to go through life knowing that takes place. So there's, you know, these instructions of, but it looks like we're shutting ourselves up from the outside. It seems very puzzling when we look at it and think, no, it's not at all that. It's on the contrary, it's how we connect. And yet, what it's pointing to is that there is no inside and outside. So that's the experience of the absolute. And again, if you think of being very precise in a situation where it flows and you are there in the moment, where's the inside and the outside? At that moment. And of course, as soon as we ask ourselves the question and we start to position and think about it, it's gone, obviously. It's gone. So it's a good, I find it's a wonderful pointer. This sentence, ordinary life fits the absolute as a box in its lid. How can we achieve that? How can we experience that? And maybe that allows us also to use the techniques that are useful, beneficial at times, knowing when we get stuck in one place or the other, and being able to also change our practice in order to cultivate what is actually a little bit weaker, maybe. Yeah, for now that's what I have to say. Any comments, questions?
Are we raising hands or can we just speak directly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, so thank you very much. I really liked your questioning because I am a bit of a nerd and I love technical human knowledge. Even in psychotherapy, when we talk, I love, you know, so how do we build an interpretation? All the technical, very technical, despite being very human with people, I'm also very technical. And I love the technicality of it. And it felt like you were describing the technicality of meditation. So that got me really interested. So thank you for that. I don't have your theoretical knowledge between different schools of meditation, so I can't contrast and compare. I mean, I understood the comparisons, but I don't have the basis to elaborate on that. But it made me reflect on my own experience of meditating and how it's happening for me. And I distrust the idea of taking yourself to some kind of place where in your being, where you stop discriminating between pleasant and unpleasant. I distrust that idea because if I'm not discriminating between pleasant and unpleasant, then how do I know what's harder to accept at a certain moment? You know, I don't get to an answer on that. So it feels to me, and all my knowledge about how human beings function at this point, you know, points to the opposite direction. It feels to me a very idealized idea of human beings that you can say, take yourself into a state where you stop discriminating between pleasant and unpleasant. We don't, even neurobiologically, we don't function that way. So it feels like an idealization. I mean, if you tell me that we shouldn't stop ourselves from naming the unpleasant, you know, yes, we can't. We have to name the unpleasant. Of course we have to. But to take ourselves to a point of discrimination where pleasant versus unpleasant is not in our world, I can't quite know. I don't even know what that looks like, to be honest. So that's one thing, you know, I distrust that. And I want to hear your comments on that. And the second thing is, I've caused all kinds of reflections about how I'm meditating at this point. I'm not going to go into them because it would be too long. But I suppose that the questions that I'm interested in at this point regarding meditation is, how is it happening at a certain point of one's lives? I have an idea of the sort of different sequences by which my meditation happens, not when I'm in it, but if I reflect on it from the outside, you know, how it is happening, how it is changing. And is there a meta message on the way that we're meditating? For example, I've learned about myself that when we are in a group situation, I cry a lot during my meditation, but it's changing because I used to gulp and start to search for air. And these days I very serenely cry when I'm meditating with you. What does that mean? Does it mean that I'm suppressing tears outside the meditation? Does it mean that I'm connecting to a form of grief that isn't just my own isolated grief, but the unprocessed grief that exists in the bigger world at this point? What is the meta message on how I am meditating at this point? And I'm really interested in that question, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. And thank you, by the way, for your talk.
I feel asking you a question that would tackle the first question too, but both questions actually. You know, when you say, you know, you cry, that, you know, is there any discrimination at that point?
I don't know. That's the honest answer. I don't know yet if there's a discrimination at that point. Maybe there's a discrimination when I'm out of it, because then I start questioning, why was I crying? No, wait, no, that's not true. That's not true. There is discrimination in the moment after a while, because I go, why am I crying again? For God's sake, you know, and then judge on it. So there is discrimination,
as you said,
in it. Yeah.
As you said, after a while.
After a while, yeah.
Maybe after a while, when you start to reflect, oh, what did it mean, right?
Yeah.
So that experience of non-discrimination, you have it right there.
Okay.
Right? So, you know, it's like, how do we embrace our experience? You know, we could say, the first tasks that, when Stephen Batchelor summarizes the Four Noble Truths and translates it into four tasks, the first noble truth is embrace your experience. Or
yeah,
as Bernie would say, bear witness. How do you bear witness? Well, you can bear witness by saying, oh, this arises, that arises. Or you can bear your experience by like, bah, and suddenly there are tears. There's suffering, there's emotion, and that comes in a bulk.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, how do you approach the embracing?
I have an answer for that, based on my own personal experience. Shall I share it with you, or is it, well, shall I not? I don't know.
Yeah, but I'm saying, you see, in what I was saying, you know, when you didn't understand how that works, you know, this is what I was saying, you know, there's one way to approach it, which is you discriminate, and it's really fun. It's probably very important to be able to distinguish, and also just like, you know, knowing how to just open up whatever that is without even thinking about it, without just, and that is equally important, I find, equally important, you know, and then, but that's the process you describe. After a while, I reflect on it, and it's like, oh, where did that come from? Da da da. But the moment when it arises, it's just, it's there. It's just there. The moment you take your cup of tea, you know, it's like less dramatic. The moment you take a cup of tea, not thinking about it, just like doing it, you know, in a retreat, you're like, okay, you're trying to be mindful and you take the cup of tea and you pour the tea and you try not to burn yourself with the tea and all that. That's it. That's it. It's like you're right there. Right. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I was very good at being mindful. Yeah, but that's gone. Then you just, then you start to be off, right?
I guess I'm finding my own specific ways of doing what you're saying at this point, you know. So when I've been crying for a while or occupied with my thoughts, I go into what I call at this point narrator's voice, like a narrator in a film. When you see a voiceover of somebody in a film, I do the same thing with myself in meditation. Oh, there you are, you're crying because of, you know, you've been here, you've been there. Okay, now your body's crying. All right. And then I bring it back to my body consciously, like, and do a body scan. Then I sometimes notice externals and see the sounds outside. Then sometimes I stop and do, well, I know it's possibly not what I should be doing, but I do a gesture of loving kindness and I put my hand circularly around my heart when I find an area of pain. And then I go back to narrator's voice and then again the body scan. And then the order can change, but I go around these four sort of movements. I'm not aware of the movements as I'm doing meditation, but I'm aware that I'm doing these movements if I reflect on it from the outside. They're there. The sequence between them changes, but they're there. And that sort of makes me feel unafraid of it, even when I judge myself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just exploring different types of different approaches. Yeah. There are different approaches.
Sure. Thank you so much. Really made me think. Thank you.
Yeah, Krisha?
Good evening, everyone. Trying to, is the sound good? Really nice to see you and hear you and listen to you, Joa, although I'm really tired and you are really serious today. In a good way. So a bit difficult to not get lost in everything you said. But I was remembering my own path in meditation since 2015, I think. And hearing Pedro, it reminded me, well, not like you, because I don't even try to get the books learning. I just try to experience, but I've done a lot of Theravada. I don't know if it's Vipassana, but it's Tara Brach sessions, and I've been with Ricardo Sasaki, which is a authorized Theravada who speaks Portuguese a lot, and being meditating with the arising of the feelings, emotions. There were some eye exercises, really simple, for you to get the notion of eating an ice cream. For me, it's awful because I hate ice cream, but eating something you like. You know, and feel the taste and feel your reaction when you like or dislike something and understand the origin. They have, the Theravada explained this really well. I don't remember the names. I would have to look. I think Tara Brach, it's really to emotions, fear. A lot of fear, understand where fear comes, where it is in your body, and I don't know. I made a lot of that practices and I like them all, but my heart goes to Zen because ultimately I don't remember the names, but imagine trying to make a guided meditation with Theravada, Bhikkhu, something, and it's really boring. There's no other way. It's really, really boring. I don't know. They take away all, I don't know, care. Although I don't know. Although Ajahn Chah is very lovey person, but other ones are very erudite. I don't know, scholastic. I don't know the name. This retreat, what it came to me was completely returning to the breath. I feel that is wising, is some kind of wisdom, personal. I don't think it's more than this. What I feel this year, I think I told you more or less everyone around March, so somewhere. Nothing of this practice helped me not to completely fall to my emotions, anxiety, and those kind of states. And it feels like let go everything, just be with your breath. Just return, return, return. If a feeling comes, if an emotion comes, I don't think now is the time to look. For me, right now in practice, it's the time to go into your breath, go into your breath, go into your breath, and rest. So I don't know what to think. I think this is, movable, but right now it almost feels like stay true to to your breath, never mind everything else. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Well, thank you, Krisha. Well, what you said and what Pedro said also, that really shows also that there are a range of practices, and that really depends on the moment, in the situation you're in, and what you feel that you actually, that it, what is, what works, what is beneficial for me at the moment. And if I feel, I mean, there was a moment where I just after my mother passed away, I couldn't work on koans. It was just not the right practice for me. I had to stop. I was devastated with pain and with grief, and that I wanted to embrace. That was the practice. And at other times, the mind is so all around the place that maybe just going back to the counting the breath is what is required. And some other times I'm calm and just shikantaza feels really nice. And some other times I do a lot of guided meditation these days, and so I try to also do what I sense is good for others, and so that they can go into learning what I call the various layers of our experience, and to be able to distinguish the various layers of our experience. But also last week I introduced them to just basically dropping, really starting to ask the question, so who am I in there? And that was for some of them, was like, wow. So diversity of practice, and I think what is very also important is to have a sense of where am I going with all that? What's the path I'm walking on? What's the intent? Not the goal, the intent. Right, not the goal. We don't want to go anywhere, but what's the intent?
Yeah, I was going to say, for me, it's like that. It's not the goal. It's the just be here right now. Doesn't
Yeah.
matter whether or not I get awake, which is never a real goal for me, I confess, because it looks something almost pretentious. just want to be there. I don't know. But I would like to ask you a thing. I don't know if it's too invasive, but if it is, let me know if it's not appropriate. It's when you were grieving your mother, and you told you felt like you needed to embrace that pain. Did you ever felt it's not indulging? I don't know how to say this in English. You are falling to pain.
Right. Yeah, I think I know what you mean. This was a big fear for me.
Yeah.
I was fearing that I was indulging in the pain, that it would keep, and it was a big fear that I would that there was a way to the keeping the pain alive was a way to keep my mother alive, something like that. But it was just a fear. So I think going back, actually, being very precise, what I was doing a lot was being very precise, not just to the pain, but noticing that very, discriminating between the sensations that came up, the thoughts that came up. And some were very, very sweet. Some were very, very happy. It was not all about sadness. It was just a huge range of emotions and be embracing that whole scope. So that changes the perspective. So that, this is where I felt. But this one of my ongoing thing is I'm always kind of scared of not the shadow, but the blank spot, that maybe there's something I don't see, there. So I'm very aware of that. It's like, okay, maybe I feel that, yeah, I haven't fallen into that trap, but I'm always a little bit suspicious that maybe I am. But I trust Roshi to be behind my back to to let me know if I if and that's why it's good to have a Roshi behind, or a wife, or a partner, or a sangha, or someone that you can and pay attention, paying attention to what they say to you, and maybe also, the question, do I go in circle? Do I feel like I'm always going back to the same thing, or am I growing? That also that might be an that was maybe an indication for me whether I was kind of feeding my grief, or I was doing something else.
Okay.
What am I feeding? What am I feeding? That's also, I find an interesting question. What am I feeding? Yeah, if I stay with a grief and I don't want to work on koans because I want to stay with my grief, am I feeding the grief, or am I doing something else? Am I cultivating something else there? I feel that's an important, that was an important question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you a lot. For me, two things you said. It's one is very beautiful to the grief is a way to make your mother still alive, not really this. I think it's really human. And the other one is seems to me with a lot of wisdom, noticing if you are in circles or if you are growing out of something. And thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that also that applies to grief, but that really applies to our whole practice. Getting out of reactivity, getting out of our habits, of ways of thinking, our compulsions, our addictions, anything that keeps us not free. That, yeah. And we're, this is again, like having that intention that I want to be free. Maybe we get stuck in circle and grow in spirals. Well, again, I mean, only us can answer that. You know, it's a question that we just need to look at. You know, where am I going with all that? You know, is it beneficial? Am I getting more stuck or am I getting less stuck, but still, you know, or does the compulsion just change, move from one form to the next, but it's still compulsion? Yeah, anyone else? We have what, we have 5 minutes, a couple of minutes. Just on one. Yeah. Yeah, Lisa.
Hello everyone. I was reflecting and thinking of when I started practicing and sitting and I started with Vipassana, and I did that for a few years, not long, 2-3 years, I guess, as I had started already also sitting it with you. And at first I remember thinking how much stronger the Vipassana practice or the mindfulness practice was, because it was, you had to put so much intent into what you were doing, so much being aware and focusing and searching and pushing and pushing and pushing, always more. And compared to that, our sitting and counting our breath seemed so easy, or not easy, but so relaxed compared to that other branch. But at the end of the day, then now I hadn't thought about it, but as you were talking, I was thinking that, well, first it's just tools. And so what you think you make of it is what you were all saying. I mean, it's what you use, what you need at one moment in time, and at some point something's going to work better than another. But it's just the tool that makes you come back to our experience. And then saying, you know, how I felt the Theravada practice was so much deeper, stronger, more focused, blah blah blah. And on top of it, you have certain sort of hierarchy. I mean, you have to go through this and then through that, and then you have different stages that you have to go to until you reach something. Where we don't have that, it's just like you, just direct experience, and it's so much more free, actually. Thinking about it, because there's no. Well, it can be, I'm sure it is often very kind of scary or puzzling, because we have nothing to hang on to. But at the same time, the whole world is there to grasp. And so, yeah, just as you were talking, that's what came up.
Yeah.
Between the two.
But I think we also need to appreciate how diverse within what we do, the variety of practices we have, you know. And I'm thinking of sitting, you know, the sitting and the koans, following the breath, or shikantaza. The koans in itself, like each time, it's like almost a new practice for each koan. It's almost like a new practice or a new kind of focus or a new way to approach things or a new puzzle, and then there's everything around it, what we do in retreats, you know, Oriyoki and chanting together and bowing, and I mean all that needs to be seen as a way to experience that absolute and that relative, or the box with its lid. Is Debbie about to speak? Or no? Okay. I was seeing you approaching the screen.
No, but thank you for this, because this, when we had this parts of this conversation on Saturday, I was still kind of hostile to this text, because after all these instructions, there's also the little paragraph at the end that says, and if you don't get it right, you're going to be like a devil's corpse or something. It's kind of threatening there at the end. So this makes it, brings it back to something much more doable.
Yeah, it said, but while you remain lost in attachments, you condemn your bodies to be corpses, or as it is sometimes expressed, to be lifeless corpses inhabited by demons. Well, I mean, think about situations where we are not mindful, where we are full, where we are grounded in some addiction. How do we feel? Do we feel full of life, or do we feel actually liveless and inhabited by something we cannot control? You know, this is a pretty good description, actually, when you are intoxicated by something, when you are caught up in your addiction, in your reactivity, in your anger, in your whatever the reaction, the process of reactivity is. Are we full of life, or are we kind of à côté de la plaque, you know, next to our shoes? I don't know how you say in English, next to our life, really, just literally, we're not fully there. We're not fully there, you know. But going back to that experience, I think it's very, it can speak to us.
It's a good point.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you so much for all that. And we'll stop here. And thank you.